Bill Barnwell, it is 11:47 p.m. Eastern time, but more importantly, man, it's been a couple of weeks, and I gotta say, doing this show at this time of night didn't feel normal without you.
Well, it's nice to be back, Pablo. I mean, I don't have stories about getting burnt for long touchdowns and getting fake congratulated for it in the locker room. I don't have stories about what it's like to actually be covering an NFL game from a stadium, but I can tell you what I saw from my couch on Sunday.
Bill Barnwell is the host of the Bill Barnwell Show podcast and also our late night NFL spirit guide. From your vantage point, from your couch, how would you even describe a week like this? This Sunday that comes after, I think, the strangest Thanksgiving that any of us probably have ever had.
Yeah, I think it actually reminded me a lot of Thanksgiving in that even though things were incredibly different, there was still some semblance of at least forced normalcy. I mean, this has been an absolutely disastrous week for the NFL in terms of teams being ravaged by the disease. We're seeing the NFL close their team facilities for Monday and Tuesday of the upcoming week. And yet, on Sunday, once the ball was in the air, things were normal. The Jets lost, the Chargers made inexplicable decisions, and the Packers blew out the Bears.
This Sunday brought all the givens of NFL action, but the league played against a backdrop of more coronavirus drama, more than it's seen in any week to date. Bill Barnwell returns to the show to break down what we saw this Sunday, from great expectations to the increasingly bizarre. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, November 30th. This is ESPN Daily. So, Bill, we just finished watching Bears and Packers, and Aaron Rodgers, to the surprise of, I think, literally nobody, just decimated the Bears and Mitch Trubisky, 41-25. So I want to turn this conversation to the horse race, the MVP conversation, because there really hasn't been a wire-to-wire frontrunner this whole time. We've seen the pendulum kind of swing. Russell Wilson, Kyler Murray was there for a hot second, Mahomes, obviously, and Aaron Rodgers, who remains squarely in the thick of it after an offseason full of drama around Jordan Love being drafted at quarterback. And yet, there is Aaron Rodgers just dominating again.
Touchdown! On a rainbow down the middle to Robert Tonyan.
Guys, that touchdown to Robert Tonyan made Aaron Rodgers the 11th QB in NFL history to pass for more than 50,000 yards. The second fastest to do it.
So where are you on the whole Rodgers for MVP thing?
Okay, so I'm inclined to pick Patrick Mahomes as my choice right now. And I think the only thing separating those two, with Russell Wilson third, is that one disastrous game Rodgers had against the Bucks earlier this season. And I think if you're going to make a case for Rodgers as MVP, I think you have to start with the idea that he's doing more with less than Mahomes has to work with and Russell Wilson has to work with. Mahomes, of course, has a dominant group of receivers with Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce leading the way. Russell Wilson has DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett. And we talked about this before the season. Rodgers has Davante Adams and a lot of question marks. Rodgers has injuries and opt-outs affecting his receiving core from week to week. And on top of that, the guys who aren't actually showing up are posting the second highest drop rate for any quarterback in the league. And yet, when you put Rodgers back there, even against a very good defense, which the Bears are, there are stretches this year where he looks absolutely untouchable. The Bears had no answers for him on Sunday night.
So the other game, Bill, that I think of when you mentioned teams that have been struggling with a paucity of just physically healthy human beings on their roster, I think of the San Francisco 49ers. And they played, I think, the most thrilling game of the day against the Rams, at least the game with the most thrilling finish. We had Robbie Gould, the kicker, breaking a 20-20 tie with a last-second game-winning field goal.
Pepper snap. Wisnowski has it down. Robbie Gould has it straight ahead. And good! The 49ers have beaten the LA Rams again! Twice this year!
And suddenly, those Niners that looked like a triage unit have like these signs of life after getting really knocked down earlier this season. So what did you see from the Niners today?
Yeah, Pablo, I mean, I think we saw a Niners team that, even though they've been beset by injuries, are finally getting some of those star players back. I don't think anybody in football has been hit harder overall by injuries this year than the 49ers, but many of the key players yesterday were guys who were coming back after missing time. Raheem Mostert ran in an early touchdown. Richard Sherman, their legendary cornerback, picked off Jared Goff, one of three giveaways from Goff in that game. And the player of the game altogether might have been Deebo Samuel, their young wide receiver, who was in the lineup for the first time since week 7 and caught 11 passes for 133 yards, including setting up that game-winning field goal. And if I'm being honest, yeah, the Niners might not have a huge ceiling with Nick Mullins at quarterback. He didn't play very well, but they won here. They got to 5-6, and in a very tough division, they kept their playoff hopes alive.
But there is this huge asterisk, right, to what's about to happen to them, because there's this hope building up. And then there's this idea that, oh, by the way, the place you play your home games may not want you to play your home games there for the foreseeable future. So what exactly is happening to the Niners in Santa Clara?
Oh, it's not may not. It's actively have been banned from playing at home. And on top of that, the 49ers found out about this news on Twitter.
Oh.
The Santa Clara local government has banned contact sports for the next 3 weeks with a 14-day quarantine for anybody traveling into the county from more than 150 miles away. So I'm not sure what will happen, but there's just something so right in 2020 about the idea of the Oakland 49ers.
So I want to get to this other huge matchup from Sunday, Bill, the one everybody was excited for. It was Patrick Mahomes and Tom Brady. It was the Chiefs and the Bucks, this dominant offense against this defense that has looked so promising. But the matchup that ended up deciding and dominating this game really was Tyreek Hill versus Carlton Davis. And I don't know if people fully appreciate what exactly was happening there. At least those who didn't have Tyreek Hill in fantasy may have felt that way. So what led to this huge day and what was going on there?
Okay. So Pablo, I know you know about the heat check in basketball.
Yes.
Okay. We don't see the heat check in football all that often. But this was Carlton Davis's heat check. We don't know Carlton Davis. He's a young cornerback for the Buccaneers. He's very good. He's had a very good season. Really a breakout year for him as one of maybe the best cornerbacks in all of football. According to Sportradar, Davis had only allowed 2 touchdown passes as the primary defender in coverage all year before Sunday. Well, unfortunately, Carlton Davis failed his heat check. He allowed 3 touchdowns to Tyreek Hill on Sunday alone. Early in this game, Todd Bowles, the excellent defensive coordinator for the Buccaneers, decided to take his chances and play more single high safety, play more man looks, and leave Carlton Davis one-on-one against Tyreek Hill. And if you are a Tyreek Hill fantasy owner, well, you know that did not work. Tyreek Hill just torched Davis up the field over and over again, ran away from the corner once he had the ball in his hands, scored 3 touchdowns.
Works the right boundary. Tyreek Hill over the shoulder. Touchdown, Kansas City, and continues Carlton Davis's nightmare day and the wonderful game for Tyreek Hill.
Todd Bowles had to make an adjustment, but by the time he stopped exposing his star corner to Hill in single coverage, Tyreek Hill had produced one of the most stunning halves in football history. We're talking about a historic day, even by the Chiefs standards.
The Bucks, Bill, they've lost 3 of 4 now. So when do they have to like gut check themselves and maybe begin to panic a little bit?
I think if you're on Twitter, you're already panicking if you're a Bucks fan. But I'm not really stressed. I have to admit, I thought the Bucks did a pretty good job here of recovering things. Granted, they dug themselves an awful hole. Tom Brady did turn the ball over twice, but they got those 2 late touchdowns to get back in the game. They slowed down the Chiefs on offense in the second half. They weren't able to get that final stop, but they did enough to make this a competitive contest instead of that Saints game a couple weeks ago where they got behind early and were never able to recover. To me right now, the issue with this team is turnovers. Over the last 4 games, when they've been kind of a mess, they turned the ball over 8 times. So it's not a particularly subtle correlation here. If they stop turning the ball over, they're going to start winning football games again. And what's ironic, I guess, here is the thing Tom Brady maybe did best in New England over the course of his run there was avoid turning the ball over. I just find it hard to believe he's suddenly forgotten about how to protect the football.
So, Bill, what can the Buccaneers do at this point then to fix this offense if that's your diagnosis of the issue?
Here is something I have been thinking about since the moment I heard Tom Brady was officially signing with the Buccaneers. I thought back to Peyton Manning's first season with the Broncos, where he really struggled to start the year in Denver. And I remembered an article that Chris Brown of Smart Football wrote for us at Grantland, where he noted that the Broncos were able to turn around an inconsistent start to Manning's tenure in Denver by getting rid of the stuff that offensive coordinator Mike McCoy and quarterbacks coach Adam Gase had planned, and basically installed more of the concepts that Manning was running in Indianapolis. Now, the Buccaneers are hitting their bye. And I wonder if this is their time to have that meeting and that conversation. Brady thrived in New England while running quick game, getting the ball out of his hands without having to worry too much about the pass rush, and taking advantage of play action, which is something the Buccaneers have not done very often, despite the fact that Brady has the fourth best QBR in football when he uses play action. I know that Bruce Arians is a no-nonsense coach. I don't think he's going to want to change things very much. But there's one guy in this organization who's making an average of $25 million per season, and it's not Bruce Arians. When push comes to shove, historically, Tom Brady's going to get his way.
Okay, up next. Bill, we need to keep talking about COVID and how the NFL addressed its biggest outbreak to date. And what we saw exactly from Broncos wide receiver turned quarterback Kendall Hinton.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
So, Bill, I really need help sorting out what is about to happen on Tuesday and how we got there, because we all spent our Thanksgiving pining for Ravens Steelers. It was initially scheduled for our holiday, did not happen in the primetime slot because both teams got positive COVID tests back, one of which, by the way, was Lamar Jackson, the quarterback of the Ravens. And so the game got postponed to Sunday, and then it got postponed to Tuesday. So how has this whole thing impacted the rosters of both teams ahead of this game?
Well, I mean, we've talked about how the NFL has become far more comfortable with letting teams play amidst COVID breakouts as the season's gone along. And nothing seems like a better example of it than what's happening with the Ravens right now. I mean, the Ravens had 5 players and 4 staffers testing positive for COVID as of Tuesday afternoon, and the game was still going to go on Thanksgiving night. It really wasn't until that number continued to rise that the league decided to push the game back until Sunday. And then once reigning league MVP Lamar Jackson tested positive, then they pushed the game back even further until Tuesday. But It's got into an extreme now. This is the most significant breakout we've seen in the NFL so far. 23 players for the Ravens are now on the COVID list, including players who've tested positive, like wide receiver Willie Snead, and star players like Mark Andrews and Matt Judon, who were added on Sunday as players who were high-risk close contacts. The Ravens have now had at least one new positive test for 8 consecutive days. And they're about to play what might be the most important game of their season against the division rival Steelers with a fraction of their usual roster. Baltimore was originally 4-point underdogs in Las Vegas. They're now 10-point underdogs heading into the game, which is still scheduled somehow to take place on Tuesday.
Why did the NFL postpone the game twice? First to Sunday, then to Tuesday, but not a third time, even as the number of players testing positive gets to the astronomical degree of 23.
So, Pablo, the league's memorandum to teams makes it clear they intend to punish those teams who are responsible for their own outbreaks, according to an NFL memorandum from Roger Goodell. Quote unquote, if a game is postponed due to one club's inability to play because of COVID cases, the burden of any competitive, financial, and other consequences will fall more heavily on that club, particularly if the club has not adhered to the health and safety protocols or has failed to cooperate in contact tracing or other reviews in response to positive tests among club players or staff. We know the Ravens have already disciplined a coach who reportedly had not mentioned his symptoms to the team and had not been abiding by mask protocols. That was apparently enough for the league to resist the urge to push this game back to a possible Week 18. It was one thing in weeks past to point out that teams would have to deal with uncertainty in 2020. But this week is bordered on farce, especially given that the NFL's press release about the postponement actually uses the phrase out of an abundance of caution, as 23 players are on the COVID list for a possible game on Tuesday. It's hard to feel like the NFL has any sort of grasp on this situation, or that they're doing anything more at this point than just holding on for dear life and hoping they can get the regular season schedule done without having to go to a Week 18.
So speaking of desperately just trying to hold on for dear life, Bill, the Broncos did play one of the weirdest football games I can remember on Sunday against the Saints. And they got to this place of strangeness because their quarterback, Jeff Driscoll, tested positive for COVID-19 and, as you mentioned, none of his colleagues at quarterback wore masks in that meeting they were all in attendance for. So none of them could play against New Orleans. So in comes Broncos wide receiver, Kendall Hinton, who lines up under center. And, well, Bill, you tell me, how did Kendall Hinton do?
Okay, before we get to the actual performance, I want to defend Kendall Hinton from what I'm about to say. I don't think we can appreciate just how ridiculous of a situation this would be for an NFL player. I mean, Kendall Hinton was 5 years removed from his only season as a full-time quarterback at Wake Forest. He was on the Denver practice squad as a wide receiver. Wasn't expecting to play at all in this game, let alone play at quarterback, a position he had not practiced to play. And with one day's notice, the Denver Broncos not only have to push Hinton into the starting quarterback role, they have to do it against a Saints defense that had held actual NFL quarterbacks who were practicing at the position to average just over 8 points per game over the past 3 weeks. Anything short of a disaster would have been an incredible performance from Hinton. And by that standard, he was incredible. He was one of nine for 13 yards.
And shotgun, Gordon to his left from the 31. Rolling to his right. Screen back to the left. It's complete. A pass is complete to Noah Fant to the left sideline. And he's out of bounds. Right near the marker. It could be a first down pass.
With two interceptions and two dropped picks. That's bad. I mean, there's no way to make those numbers look good. But there have been actual NFL quarterbacks who have had similarly bad games, including, to point one out, one Nathan Peterman, who actually made his way onto the field for a brief spell against the Falcons in garbage time on Sunday.
And so, all roads, Bill, all roads continue to lead back to the Peterman.
It's true. I felt like he had to make an appearance with all this quarterback conversation just to remind us he was there lurking in the shadows. Honestly, Pablo, I think as far as the more surprising or disappointing performance, I wouldn't look towards Hinton. I would look towards the guy on the other side of the field. The Saints did win comfortably. Their defense played great. The Broncos offered nothing on offense. And Taysom Hill did run for two touchdowns.
Design run to the right. Taysom Hill takes it in for the shotgun snap behind the right side of the line. Gets into the end zone. Hill is second rushing score. And it's 13-0 extra point coming for the Saints.
And he just doesn't look like he's an NFL caliber quarterback. He's not a fast processor. On Sunday, he was slow to diagnose defenses. He was slow to make decisions. And he didn't make accurate passes when he was getting the football out. The Saints haven't needed Hill to be a significant part of their passing attack because they've been so good on defense over the past 2 weeks. But unless Hill improves dramatically, and he's 30, it's hard to believe they're better off with the $16 million man, Taysom Hill, at quarterback, than the guy they're paying a little over $1 million, I believe, to be his backup in Jameis Winston.
So, Bill, I'm also curious about this. How are teams around the league going to react to the fact that the Broncos were left in this situation? Like, what are they going to do going forward to help avoid a situation like that?
I'm not being hyperbolic here, Pablo, in telling you every single team in the league is going to take a quarterback and put him in isolation for the remainder of this season. We already know some teams are doing that. The Bills, for example, have been doing this with rookie quarterback Jake Fromm all year. Fromm sits in for meetings on Zoom, but he practices separately at the end of practice from the rest of the team and deliberately has no contact with the other quarterbacks on the roster. It's a pretty depressing life, seemingly, but it does actually keep you prepared. Every team that has a third or fourth quarterback lurking on the practice squad, that guy is about to get very lonely over the rest of the NFL season.
But speaking of like lines of succession, Bill, there was a different kind of post-Thanksgiving shakeup in Detroit because the Lions announced that they had fired head coach Matt Patricia and general manager Bob Quinn. So why now is the real question I have here.
It's an interesting question because really Matt Patricia's entire tenure kind of felt like a 2.5 year long example of the Peter principle. The Lions fired Jim Caldwell after posting a winning record and leading Detroit to 2 playoff appearances and replaced him with hiring Patricia, who had just come off allowing Nick Foles to score 41 points in the Super Bowl against the Patriots. The Lions hired Patricia and general manager Bob Quinn to import some semblance of the Patriot way to Detroit. But Patricia really wasn't Bill Belichick. Shortly after he was hired, the Detroit News reported he had been indicted in 1996 on sexual assault charges before those charges were eventually dropped. Patricia reportedly never told the team about those charges during the interview process. The Lions coach scolded a reporter for not having appropriate posture during a press conference and deflected any criticism of his decisions, notably once suggesting amidst a series of heartbreaking fourth quarter losses that the Malcolm Butler interception he had helped being a part of with the Patriots proved he knew what he was doing late in games. A report by Kalen Collar of Bleacher Report suggested that Lions players actually drank mimosas in the locker room to celebrate the end of their first season under Patricia.
Wait, Bill, that's just the saddest boozy brunch that I think I've ever heard of in my life.
Pablo, you live in New York. You know how long you've had to wait for brunches at certain times. I would much rather go to an NFL locker room and drink mimosas than wait 2 hours in Brooklyn Heights to go get brunch somewhere. But in the end, none of that would have mattered if Patricia was a good football coach who won games, and he did not. The final straw really came on Thanksgiving. I think this was why the Lions made the move when they did. Expensively acquired Patricia additions like former Patriots linebacker Jamie Collins and third overall pick cornerback Jeffrey Okuda gave up touchdowns in a 41-25 blowout loss against the Texans. Patricia spent his time with Detroit trying to play the same man-to-man heavy coverage the Patriots play, despite not having the players or realistically the coaching aptitude to pull it off. How about teams who hire Patriots assistants are always trying to get the next Bill Belichick? Instead, most of the time, with maybe Brian Flores as the exception, they end up just hiring a guy who can cut the sleeves off of his own hoodie.
So, Bill, I want to wrap up our conversation here in the way that we often do on ESPN Daily, either on purpose or because the cosmos brings us together in this way. But the NFC East, a lot has happened there since we last talked. And the New York Giants are New York football giants, Bill Barnwell. They have taken the lead thanks to their win over the Bengals on Sunday. And look, the Eagles play tonight on Monday Night Football. I don't know what happens in terms of tiebreakers. Certainly, there's a big mess ahead in all senses. But how did the Giants claw their way to the top of this god-awful dumpster fire?
Oh, I've missed talking about the NFC East with you, Pablo. Let me be clear. Let me be clear here. The Giants are not a good football team. Do not get fooled by a 3-game winning streak. I know, yes, they were better than their 1-7 record to start this season. But their first 3-game winning streak since 2016, let's be honest, it's a product of the teams they have played. They beat the Washington football team, they beat the Eagles, and they beat the Bengals, who lost Joe Burrow last week. Two of those 3 games were against teams who were using their third-string quarterbacks for most of the contest. The Giants have won exactly 1 game by more than 3 points all season, and they were in danger of blowing a significant lead to a guy who was on the practice squad earlier this week in Brandon Allen.
Yeah.
Now, the reality is, you don't have to be good to win the NFC East. You just have to be the last team standing. And according to The Upshot, the Giants have a 34% chance of making it to the postseason. And if you want to understand why they have a 34% chance of making it to the postseason, their formula mostly revolves around kicker Graham Gano, who has gone 25 of 26 on field goals tries this year, including 4 of 4 on Sunday in the win over the Bengals.
Hey.
The Giants got Gano back from the COVID list. They did lose starting quarterback Daniel Jones to a hamstring injury. And in a normal universe, starting 4-7 and losing your starting quarterback would typically cause you to give up on the season and think about next year. But in a division where the only starting quarterback left standing is Carson Wentz, and that might not last past Monday night, anything is possible.
That is the optimism that only comes when you have Bill Barnwell back in your starting lineup on ESPN Daily.
I saw Eli Manning win 2 Super Bowls, Pablo. Anything is possible.
All right, coming up, the only event that could possibly relegate Mike Tyson's huge comeback to a footnote.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Here's another story I want you to know. When I paid $49.99 to a website I'd never heard of to stream a 54-year-old Mike Tyson fighting a 51-year-old Roy Jones, I had no idea that would be the second most dystopian experience of my night. That fight, which Tyson clearly won, by the way, but was declared a draw because it's boxing, so of course it was, actually felt relatively normal. Mostly because this happened in the fight immediately before.
Let me stand.
Wow, nothing funny about what's happening with Nate Robinson, but Snoop Dogg is singing the hymns. He's trying to get
the ring.
Mamma mia, the problem child proven to be a big problem.
To answer a couple questions real quick, yes, that was Snoop Dogg commentating. Yes, that was former NBA guard Nate Robinson on the floor. And yes, the big winner in all of this was Jake Paul, aka The Problem Child, a deliberately odious YouTuber whose controversies section on Wikipedia has 10 paragraphs and 1,822 words, several of which are racial epithet and FBI investigation. Before Saturday, Paul had competed in precisely 1 pro fight. Robinson had fought in 0. But it seems telling that their match, despite being an algorithmically generated Mad Lib and despite involving no actual boxers, is what dominated the internet this weekend. Thanks largely, by the way, to Robinson's first ballot induction into the Hall of Memes. Now, boxing has always been desperate to game the attention economy. I love the craft of the sport, but its core business model, pay-per-view, quite openly means money for eyeballs. It predates the concept of trolling for clickbait by decades. And today, it feels like those two concepts have finally converged into a sports content singularity named Jake Paul that we honestly should have seen coming for a while now. Because for a very long time, our country kept saying that boxing was dead. We worried that a game built around risking public humiliation for glory and safety for money would age out of cultural relevance and get left behind as society advanced, as Tyson himself once feared.
boxing was pretty much a dying sport. UFC was kicking our butt. And now we got these YouTube boxes. Boxing's been 25 million views. Boxing's going back thanks to the YouTube boxes.
Thinking back on those fears now, it was as if we had never seen a single YouTube video or tweet or been on the internet in general, where 23-year-olds like Jake Paul are trained to draw eyeballs by promising that public humiliation and then daring us to look away. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.